Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Jane Donahue. Today we begin our four-part series from the 37th Annual Camden Conference, which was held February 16th through the 18th and hosted by Marketplace Morning Report's David Brancaccio. The topic was India, Rising Ambitions, Challenges at Home. This program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time, and it will be archived on our website, mainepublic.org. Click on radio to hear the program again at your convenience and to access many other past Speaking in Maine programs. The program will also be available as a podcast. On today's program, Nirupama Rao and Emily Schmall. Nirupama Rao served as India's Foreign Secretary from 2009 to 2011. Before that, she was the first female spokesperson of the Indian Foreign Office from 2001 to 2002. As well as serving as India's ambassador to the United States, China, and Sri Lanka.
We have an amazing speaker to kick things off tonight. Nirupama Rao. She has served as India's foreign secretary from 2009 to 2011. That's like our Secretary of the State, if you're not getting it. This followed a long foreign service career that included assignments as the first woman spokesperson of the Indian Foreign Office and as India's ambassador to the US and China. And for those of you here of an age, you've gotten to that point in life when you reflect on maybe second acts as you pivot to spend more time not doing what your original career was, but doing something more what you love, you should know that Ambassador Rao is also a famous performer, a singer, who in 2018 released a record album, Peace Is My Dream. She's also worked to bring cultures and artists across countries and continents together through high-profile music events. Back to the policy work. Ambassador Rao has been a senior visiting fellow in international and public affairs at Brown University's Watson Institute, and as George Ball Adjunct Professor at Columbia's School of International and Public Affairs. Many publications, including a book from really just 2021, The Fractured Himalaya, India, Tibet, China, 1949-1962. Ambassador Rao has been a fellow at a glowing list of US-based policy institutions, Global Policy Fellow at the Wilson Center, and she's received a Fellowship of Peace Award from the Mahatma Gandhi Memorial Center in Washington back in 2018. Let us give it up for Nirupama Rao. Madam Secretary, welcome.
Thank you, David Brancaccio, for those words of introduction. And it's wonderful to be here in Maine, in Camden, this evening. I just flew in here from many thousands of miles away, many leagues, as they would say, if, you know, given the fact that you have lived, your history has been lived in a very maritime environment. So I come from many leagues away. And as David was saying, there in the east lies India. I came in here from the city of Bangalore. I lived there in the south of India, in what we call peninsular India. And Bangalore is a city of many contrasts. In fact, I grew up there when it was a very quiet city with leafy boulevards. It used to be called the pensioner's paradise. And just to illustrate the way India has changed in my lifetime, I want to say that today Bangalore is a city of teeming millions. It's grown in every direction. It's a huge metropolis. I would say a cosmopolis because it attracts people from all over the world. And it's a city of innovation. It's a hub for research. It's the what we like to call the Silicon Valley of India. So that, in a way, I am saying in order to illustrate the fact that India is a land of so many contrasts. And Bangalore is just one example of that. Now, when I was thinking of the connections between Maine and India, I just decided, as an off chance, to see if one of our great gurus, I would say, a spiritual leader of India, Swami Vivekananda, had come to Maine. I just felt that since he'd been in Chicago in 1893 for the Great Parliament of Religions, and I knew that he had spent some time in New England, in some of the states of New England, I just decided to sort of check whether he had been in Maine. And sure enough, I came across this reference to a visit that he'd made in 1894 to Greenacre, which is in Elliott, Maine. He'd been invited here by a woman called, I'm trying to get his name, Sarah Farmer. She invited Swami Vivekananda to spend some time in what I would say was an earlier version of the Camden Conference, because she had set up this kind of platform to which she invited illustrious speakers from all over the world. And Swami Vivekananda was one of them. And he spent apparently 2 months here and was avidly listened to by a lot of Maine residents. And apparently there are pictures of him attired in his flowing red robes and yellow turban, sitting cross-legged on the ground near a wide-spreading pine and surrounded by a group of eager listeners, men and women, to whom, as this account says, he pours out freely his treasures of knowledge and experience. And writing of his experience, Swami Vivekananda says that the people were healthy, young, sincere. He called them holy men and women. And he taught them to recite the Hindu words, Shivoham, which means, you know, seeking the blessings of Shiva, Lord Shiva. And they all repeated, these are his words, innocent and pure as they are, and brave beyond all bounds. So I just thought I'd mention this, you know, this old connection that goes back over a century. But speaking of Maine and talking of connections between India and America, one of the first exports from the United States to India, to, you know, so-called British India at that time, was ice, was really, you know, water. It didn't pour cold water on the relationship. In fact, it made it thrive. And so from 1833 onwards, you had shipments of ice from Maine to Calcutta. And they reached Calcutta quite intact, you know, with a little bit of melting here and there, but nothing like, you know, the global warming of today. So, you know, there you have it. You have ice. And I wanted to add a personal anecdote. You know, when I grew up in India, and I'd never been to America till I was in my early 30s, but I did study literature, and in my graduate class, I did a semester studying American literature. And American literature, especially early American literature, when you study Nathaniel Hawthorne and you study Herman Melville, it's all about New England, and Herman Melville especially, and I loved his writing and just the fire and passion of it all. And it evokes so much of what, you know, the environment in which you are situated. Astride the ocean, and all the whaling and the history of maritime activity in this part of America was all reflected in the American literature that I studied as a young woman, and in the heart of India. I mean, it was in somewhere in central India, by a professor who'd spent a year in America and came back full of stories about your wonderful country. So that is my personal connection going back so many, so many decades. So coming to the topic on which I've been asked to speak to you, it's about how India sees the world. And I'd like to start first by saying how I, as an Indian woman, sees the world. And where I come from today, the India that I come from today, and especially when you talk about the women of India. Now, in China, there's a saying that women hold up half the sky.
And Swami Vivekananda, whom I spoke to you about, you know, who'd come to Maine, he says that women are like, you know, like a bird has two wings, women are one of those wings, and a bird cannot fly unless, you know, both wings are operational. So today, what we are trying to do in India is to give women more representation. We have tremendous aspirations being articulated by the women of India. We are talking about their rights, their representation, ultimately and most importantly, their voice. And I come from the profession of diplomacy. And in my own life and in my own career, I've seen how the representation of women has gone up in our foreign service. Starting from a time when women who joined the foreign service, as in many other foreign services across the world, had to give up their careers when they married. We were faced with similar situations in the early years of the inception of our foreign service. And slowly but surely, things changed, they improved, they evolved. And most importantly, they involved the struggles of many women in the service in order to seek more rights for themselves and to see justice served. And that's why I'm here before you today. And I've often felt that when it comes to the problems that the world faces today, geopolitically and all the divisions and all the polarizations that we face, that we need more of a feminist voice in diplomacy also. Because women, I mean, our role through history across the world has been involved with healing, with bridging, with integrating. And that's really the space in which I think women being situated in that space can do so much more, provided, as I said, they are given the rights, they have the representation, and their voices are heard. Now, many of you, some of you have been to India, many of you have not, and especially to the young ones who are watching me here today, what is India? I ask that question. And I'm often reminded of what Winston Churchill, and may I just qualify here that Winston Churchill is not one of the most popular figures in India, but be that as it may, he is a man of history. And he had this to say on Russia, that it was a riddle wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma. And I think that very much applies to India, especially those outside India and those who are not familiar with India and who haven't been to India. But I would acknowledge that interpreting India is a challenge. And as an Indian, immersed in the experience of being Indian, perhaps it's less of a challenge because, you know, people like me who live in India, who are born in India, who belong to the soil of India, we live there, we breathe the air of India. But I'd say that India, very much like the United States, but a much older, a much more adult version of the United States, is defined by diversity. It's defined by its multitudes. And again, I remember an American poet, Walt Whitman, when he said, "I am large, I contain multitudes." And I think that really applies to India too. Now you in America, in this heartland, separated by the seas from the rest of the world, have your own national foundation stones. Your image of this sweet land of liberty, your legacy of freedom from sea to shining sea. And ours in India is a history as the place of every arrival, of conquest, of colonization, of assimilation, of adaptation, of a nonviolent struggle on which we shared the copyright with the rest of the world, including with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. We are a mosaic of languages, religions, and ethnicities, not a melting pot, not like what you are. We're a mosaic, and we celebrate difference, and for the most part have not translated difference into conflict. We have given coexistence our own unique stamp of originality. Now, as the largest country in the world in terms of population, David just mentioned that, we see ourselves as the largest everything. There is a depthlessness, which is the exact opposite of the lack of depth, so don't mistake me, about India, which perhaps is not easy for our foreign friends to easily comprehend. India's uniqueness derives from a geography of continental proportions, a peninsular region abutting two seas and an ocean, our northern region bordering the fastnesses of Central Asia, our western region oriented towards the Arabian Peninsula and the eastern coast of Africa, and our northeast being a gateway to Southeast Asia. The India I have lived in, and I, you know, began life as the child of a very newly independent country in the 1950s, is a country that has and is still undergoing radical transformations. It's no longer the India that lives in stereotypes of Kipling and John Masters. This is a country that is a raucous, thriving democracy, resilient for all the angularities that our critics point to, where balance and equilibrium are maintained in our daily lives, despite the teeming millions in our cities, the impossible traffic, and the pollution. We are what America was in its growing decades, except that, you know, you had many much more wide open spaces. We are what you were, constantly evolving, immensely aspirational. We're a young country, an old civilization, but a young country. Our population is young, and they look outwards. They seek better lives, and they are growingly literate. They have open minds. We will touch the sky, they proclaim. They are ready to fly, and they glow like fireflies. India is building its season of hope today. Its spacecraft are on the moon and exploring the sun. It's also a season of fundamental change. India seeks its definitions on everything. It takes autonomy seriously. We are on nobody's side but our own. Our first Prime Minister, Jawaharlal Nehru, said long years ago, soon after we made our tryst with destiny as a free nation. If India is defined by anything, it is by complexity. We are a union of states, and like our gods, we have multiple identities. Do not take us at face value. Study us intensely. Like Ralph Waldo Emerson, another New Englander, once said, study us like a science, not like a recreation. Which is why I think more and more universities, as in this country, need to encourage the study of India, as you did for China so many decades ago. I am an Indian who thinks that our strength is rooted in our capacity to manage diversity and to ensure that our republic is socially just and non-discriminatory. I see that as an article of faith, as a citizen of my country. Now, India is not for the faint-hearted. Our American friends have traditionally been quick to, metaphorically speaking, I weigh my words carefully, metaphorically speaking, draw the gun on India. They see us more, but understand us less. Their interpretations of India tend to be more literal than educated. India sees the world today as an arena of big responsibility and bigger ambitions. Its vision is its own. Its leadership feels there is a need to catalyze a new mindset, a sense of oneness, and to move beyond confrontation. India does not see the world through the lens of ideology, either Western or Eastern. Our Prime Minister, Mr. Narendra Modi, says that this need not be an era of war. that it must not be one, that climate change, terrorism, and pandemics are the greatest challenges we face. We believe technology and the new frontiers being reached in the field can change the story of our development, leapfrogging us into the future that awaits. Now, we would like honest conversations among the most powerful countries and to depoliticize the global supply of food, fertilizers, and medical products, including vaccines, so that geopolitical tensions do not lead to humanitarian crises. As our leaders say, we'd like a human-centric globalization. Interconnectedness, as we see the world, is our future, not compartmentalization, because trade, migration, technology, the digital space, they all weave complex linkages between countries and peoples. Now, we in India see ourselves as part of this large agglomeration that we call the Global South. And we see ourselves as a lead voice in this grouping. We're concerned about the vulnerability of peoples in the Global South to conflict and division, strife and population dislodgement because of the threats posed to our development, our security, our health, education, and of course on climate vulnerability and occupational mobility because of the upheavals in the world today. We're against the weaponization of trade or interdependence. We're against economic sanctions that are like scattershot, meant for certain targets, but affecting us even more than the latter. Their aimlessness endangers our well-being, and we oppose them, therefore. We see the world as in need of bridging rather than division. It is a world where geopolitical tectonics are shifting, literally a moving of the ground beneath our feet. Throughout our history, we've steered clear of entrapment in others' wars. I know that, and we all know, the West would like India to take sides, but as the song goes, we shall not be moved. Except if we determine that it is in our interest to shift positions. I've said before, and I quote, the road to global leadership is open for India today. You know, we just heard mentioned that it's soon to be the third largest economy in the world. It's the largest population, the youngest demographic. The potential is all there, one of the largest militaries in the world. Since credentials for a seat at the high table of world power are basically founded on military and economic strength, and in India's case, it's buttressed, and I say this without a sense of vanity, it's buttressed by civilizational and cultural values and attributes, and all of which, therefore, mark India's rise. Now, India is situated in a region of Asia which is made for multipolarity and not a duality. And I refer to this particularly in the context of the escalating rivalries that we've seen between China and the United States. And I refer to the impact of this rivalry in the region that we call the Indo-Pacific, which stretches from the east coast of Africa to the shores of California. Now, countries like us in this region, and particularly middle powers such as India is, do not want it that way. We don't want to see these escalating rivalries. I'll come to India's relationship with China separately, but I'm talking of this larger, you know, contest between two of the biggest powers in the world. And countries like India and countries in the Global South would prefer to see the region as multipolar, as traditionally it was. Because when you look at the seas that surround us in our region, these were seas for traffic and commerce, for the interchange of religions and ideas and cultures. And, you know, these were human seas, and today they've, you know, it's changed. And because they've changed because of the impact of superpower rivalry, and it is harmful to the interests of countries that belong to the region. This region, the Indo-Pacific, to which we belong, is vast. 36 countries, 16 time zones, 60% of the time, the world's population. It's a vast maritime expanse, and it's defined by the centrality of sea power and the busiest trade channel in the world, which is the Indian Ocean, the ocean to which India has given its name. Perilous passages are being navigated in the Indo-Pacific. And I believe things could reach a level of maximum danger in this decade. Hot spots include the Taiwan Straits, no prizes for guessing. And the challenge for us, and the challenge basically, I would say, for the United States and its partners, is to craft a strategy that blunts Chinese muscularity and assertiveness in the region, and at the same time maintains a balance, an equilibrium, and a stability that ensures the growth and development of this region, because that is really the focus that we desire, and that is really where our primary geopolitical concerns lie. Now, when it comes to India, I would say, given our position, we are realists and pragmatists in the operation of our foreign policy. We have resisted dominance and isolation through our independent history. We want connectivity, we want cooperation, we want a genuine respect for the global commons. You know, India is one country where, you know, you use the word global commons in English, but the word commons, as you define it, and as we also define it, exists in most Indian languages. It's there in all our land and revenue documents. Every village has its commons. Every, you know, in South India, in Kerala, where I come from, it's called Perambok, the word commons, Perambok. It defines land which is, you know, the commons, which belongs to everybody, which has to be developed in that fashion. And that's where, you know, our stress on inclusivity and the adherence to international rules and norms comes in. Our foremost foreign policy relationship today is with the United States, and it represents a collective investment by leaders in both our countries for this relationship, and it involves a breadth of issues and structures, and even our differences, and there are differences, we discuss with openness and candor, and with mutual sensitivity. And of course, we deal with American evangelism on democracy and human rights in our own way. And we say, who should cast the first stone? I think realpolitik prevails ultimately. And I also believe that the foreign policy of a country cannot be slotted into convenient definitions of multi-alignment or non-alignment. It needs to be free and energetic, bold and uncompromising when it comes to the sovereign and national interest. We believe in the autonomy of our decision-making, being slave to none, keeping in mind our security concerns, and to be a unifying voice of reason and resilience in a polarized world. Traditional alliances have never been our choice. We favor multifaceted partnerships with key countries, and the United States leads the list. And obviously, like for any country, our foreign policy is forged on the anvil of our domestic concerns, our security, our development, and our economic growth. Now, our China relationship is not in a good place today, and that to me is an unfortunate situation, because China is too close for comfort, geographically. Our borders are disputed with China, and they are long, stretching across the most difficult geographies in the world, where the Himalayas are forbidding frontiers. Our relationship with China has been recently bloodied by the deaths in June 2020 of 20 of our soldiers in the area we call Eastern Ladakh. It's high altitude terrain, about 18,000 feet above sea level, extremely forbidding geography. And there's been no process of recovery in this relationship since then. The template is disturbed, the trust deficit is unparalleled, and recalls the levels reached after the brief conflict between our two countries of 1962, which I wrote about in my book. But moving beyond China, and before I stop, I have exactly 3 minutes and 22 seconds left. So we see the need for the world to engage in a fundamental reform of multilateral institutions like the World Bank, the IMF, and the United Nations Security Council. And again, come back to the central point, we want voice, we want representation, we want votes with weight. Weight that validates our numbers, our rights, our aspirations, and our ability to contribute to peace and development. And India has that capacity to make that contribution. Our economy is a front-ranking one today, behind only that, as we said, heard earlier, of the United States, China, Japan, and Germany. And our strength has to be measured not in GDP per capita, but the capacity to exert influence and power in our neighborhood and in the Indo-Pacific, and with our partners, our partner democracies, as we have in the Quad, the organization that we call the Quadrilateral Dialogue, the United States, Japan, and Australia. And our assets as a country include a stable democracy, our military strength, and our strong institutions of state and governance. Having been a member of India's civil service, I can vouch for that. As I said, we approach the world with disciplined pragmatism, a readiness for dialogue, and reasonable compromise. And we would like a world built on cosmopolitanism and an interchange of ideas, trade, technology, and security for human populations across the planet, especially gender-based development. As a woman, I'd like to say that. So I know that since time is running out, I should probably go into diminuendo, as it were, now, and since it's the Opera House. But let me end by saying that I stand here as a country, as a member of a country, as a citizen of a country from the Global South, and let me say, tell you all that the Global South has a heart. It's a heart that's willing to share, and we have solidarity on our side, and we want to share the future of progress with other countries in the world, and the only way to ensure it is to move beyond conflict and polarization. We've got many miles to go as a country. I acknowledge that. India has many miles to go, and it will be a long journey. But today, we are a country brimming with the will to achieve the goals before us. And India believes in a place called hope. And we've made our stop there and drink from that spring on that hill where the green grass grows. Thank you.
Emily Schmall is an award-winning correspondent for the New York Times. She served as a South Asia correspondent for the Times, where she covered government policy, social uprisings, economic inequality, the rise of Hindu nationalism, and India's struggles to include more women in its economy.
Well, thank you. I love that montage. I'm a bit of a thrill seeker, and so I took up driving in Delhi, and it never disappointed. Thank you so much to the organizers of the Camden Conference for inviting me to speak here. It's such an honor. And I want to thank everyone listening to this talk today for your interest in journalism in India and the very powerful counter-narrowism pushed by the government of Prime Minister Narendra Modi. As the fastest growing large economy in the world, India is on the rise. So too are its geopolitical fortunes. Countries like the United States, Britain, Israel, and Russia are all vying for better access to its market, touted as an alternative to China for investments in manufacturing. At the same time, they court its diplomats for support. Here you see President Biden toasting Prime Minister Modi at a state dinner last June. Of course, this rise began long before Mr. Modi took the helm in New Delhi in 2014. But India's growing stature in the world under Mr. Modi has a bearing on how journalism and democracy are practiced. India's new strategic position means that the government has been largely absolved for a disturbing pattern of human rights abuses that have targeted the large minority Muslim population, as we've heard this morning. And it has been given a pass on its increasingly brazen crackdown on journalists and advocates of free speech, transparency, and accountability. To be clear, journalism is under threat in India. But I want to start this talk by acknowledging that the media landscape is still very vibrant, thanks to the daring of its reporters and editors and the dedication of its readers, listeners, and viewers. Journalists still play a vital function in Indian democracy, but the conditions in which they do their jobs are less and less free and more dangerous. At the same time, Mr. Modi's government and the ruling Bharatiya Janata Party, or BJP, is using all the communication channels at its disposal, from popular TV networks to WhatsApp groups, to dominate the political discourse in India and in the diaspora. And the semi-mechanized propaganda that has the power to corral votes and incite violence becomes even more treacherous in the new era of AI. Every institution in this large, bustling, chaotic, incredible nation, not just the media, is challenged. Mr. Modi is centralizing power in the Prime Minister's office in New Delhi. He and the Hindu right are deeply invested in how this historical moment is portrayed and understood, both within and outside of India, and that comes down to control. It is now broadly understood, both among high-level bureaucrats and humble shopkeepers, that anyone pushing back against this campaign of control could face real and dire consequences. Mr. Modi rather famously rarely gives interviews or press conferences. He has no need. So it was a bit of a coup for the Financial Times to sit down with him recently. The tenor of what he said in the parts of the interview published by the FT expressed the confidence of a politician poised to win re-election and a head of state fated by world leaders and business tycoons. But when the journalists asked him about a crackdown on critics in India, he responded with a, quote, long and hearty laugh. A strange response in a context where journalists are jailed, newsrooms are raided, NGOs are cut off from funding, and a slate of legislation is being passed that is designed to curtail speech. All of that said, I hope to leave you today with a sense of hope. India's story, after all, is still very much being written. Allow me to give a quick overview of the news landscape in India. India is a nation of superlatives, and that's true of its news market, the largest in the world. From 2021 to 2022, the combined circulation of all daily newspapers was more than 225 million copies, according to the government. More than 225 million newspapers printed, distributed, and read every day. It's a newswoman's dream in many ways. And every weekday afternoon during my 4.5 years working in Delhi, I'd take a walk around Connaught Place, which is home to many of the city's newsrooms, and see people thumbing through newspapers. Office drones, students, rickshaw pullers, it's a wonderful sight. In 2012, Ken Auletta wrote in The New Yorker that, quote, India is one of the few places on earth where newspapers still thrive. A dozen years later, that's still very true. The daily circulation of newspapers has doubled since 2012. The trade association WARC estimates that about half of urban India reads a newspaper every day. There are also hundreds of TV news channels, many of them highly influential and highly partisan. Cheap to produce shouting matches dominate like they do here. Republic TV, something akin to India's Fox News, is unapologetically pro-government, and that used to set it apart. No longer. Both TV and newspapers derive a huge share of their advertising income from the government, especially since the pandemic, when other ad buyers withdrew. NDTV, the last bastion of independent TV news, was acquired by one of the world's richest men, energy tycoon Gautam Adani, seen here in Ahmedabad. The fortunes of Mr. Adani have risen alongside Mr. Modi's. Adani won NDTV in a hostile takeover bid in 2022, and since then, many of the network's longtime anchors and executives have stepped down. But increasingly, the biggest scoops, the gutsiest investigations, and the best watchdog reporting are appearing not in newspapers or TV, but in the digital pages of scrappy online news startups. Much of this work is supported by grants and reader subscriptions and donations, and the journalists doing this work are particularly targeted by the government and its supporters. Back in 2012, internet use was limited. Now, roughly half of this country of 1.4 billion is online, according to the Reuters Institute at Oxford. Indians use more smartphone data than the US and China combined. The media landscape online is exploding as a result. Again, according to Reuters, more than half of respondents said they got their news on YouTube and WhatsApp. It's a bit of a problem because WhatsApp and other digital communication platforms are very efficient at feeding misinformation, whipping up nationalist fervor, and organizing hate. There has been such a high incidence of violence attributed to India's most popular chat platform that researchers coined the term, quote, WhatsApp lynchings. This picture by my friend, the late photographer Danish Siddiqui of Reuters, shows a group of Hindu men beating a Muslim man during sectarian violence in Delhi in 2020. This is a riot that broke out over the Citizenship Act that was spoken about this morning. I alluded at the beginning of this talk to what good journalism is up against in India, and part of it is this: misinformation that bombards Indians through apps on their phones. Also, the Modi government uses its heft as a large ad buyer to muzzle the mainstream press, and it uses legal warfare to discredit, censor, and silence the journalists who dare to present a reality that is contrary to the one the BJP and its supporters have invested so much to project. Mr. Modi's PR machine is a thing to behold. The Prime Minister has become larger than life, standing tall in towering billboards across the capital, speaking in weekly radio addresses, and traveling around the country for ceremonial groundbreakings on projects that concretize a Hindu nationalist vision. His governance style is constant campaign mode. Modi's image is ubiquitous, but also carefully curated. The state-run and other co-opted media often depict Mr. Modi standing alone, a sober, almost ethereal, godlike figure. And to his supporters, criticism of him or his government's policies, which his party conflates into being one and the same, has become a kind of blasphemy. The untold sums the government and the BJP and its supporters are spending on publicity appear to be a very sound investment, because more and more of the country is falling in line. Recent evidence of this is the inauguration of the Ram Temple in Ayodhya. Again, this is a Hindu temple that was built on the rubble of a 450-year-old mosque that was torn down by Hindu nationalist activists in 1992. It was an act of terrorism that left 2,000 dead. A dark day for India. Not so in the new India of Mr. Modi and his supporters, whose revisionist take on history is literally taking form brick by brick. Seizing the site and building a temple to the Hindu god Ram, who Hindus believe was born in Ayodhya, has been a cornerstone of the Hindu nationalist project for decades. But what seemed an outrageous and fringe idea in the 1990s has become a pillar of a popular prime minister's re-election campaign this year. The temple's inauguration in January had all the pomp and circumstance of a national holiday. Even the Delhi government, which is run by the opposition AAP party, jumped on the bandwagon, ordering a half day at school so that teachers could watch the prime minister at the partially built temple in wall-to-wall cable TV news coverage. My colleagues Mujib Mashal and Hari Kumar were there in Ayodhya, and they reported, quote, As a show of laser lights and bone-jarring beats went on in the background, about a dozen national television channels tried to outdo each other in what for most has become a guiding mission, to shine a favorable spotlight on the Prime Minister's every move. So deeply enthralled is the popular press to Mr. Modi that the government's setbacks, from Chinese troop incursions across India's border, to an economy that has failed to produce enough jobs for young people, especially women, to an ethnic conflict brewing in the Northeast, receive on the whole far less attention. This is a picture of Indian soldiers in eastern Ladakh, a region high in the Himalaya, where 20 Indian soldiers were killed in a clash with Chinese troops in 2020. In the recent interview with the FT, Mr. Modi spoke about the work of changing perceptions. He was addressing a question about corruption, but I think we can read his answer more broadly. He said, quote, "It's important to recognize that India wouldn't have achieved the status of the world's fastest growing economy if the issues you've highlighted were as pervasive as suggested. Often," he said, "these concerns stem from perceptions, and altering perceptions sometimes takes time." Altering public perceptions for the Modi government has involved more than just projecting the Prime Minister's image everywhere. It has also involved punishing critics who question his dogma. Indian journalists have endured raids, harassment, arrests, and imprisonment. The government has spied on them using Pegasus, and it has charged them with the highest crimes in India, offending religious sentiment, sedition, and even terrorism, simply for toiling away as reporters. Thousands of people have been detained in India under the Unlawful Activities Prevention Act, including poets, political organizers, and even an elderly Catholic priest with Parkinson's disease who died in custody. The UAPA has also been used against journalists. There are 13 journalists currently who are being tried or investigated, according to the Committee to Protect Journalists. One of them is Sadiq Kapan, a reporter from Kerala who was arrested on his way to the scene of an alleged gang rape of a teenage Dalit girl in the state of Uttar Pradesh. The girl later died of her injuries. Mr. Kapan was traveling to the city of Hathras when he was stopped at a toll plaza. He and his taxi driver were taken into custody by the Uttar Pradesh police. The top official in Uttar Pradesh, for those who don't know, is a Hindu priest and powerful BJP leader. For merely intending to report on the gruesome sexual assault of a Dalit girl by Hindu men, Mr. Kapan was charged with sedition, promoting enmity among religious groups, and UAPA. Here he is 2.5 years later, with his family after he was released from prison. Unsatisfied, apparently, with the criminal law procedures the government has at its disposal to threaten, intimidate, and silence journalists, the government has introduced rules to better harness what's published online. The so-called IT rules have created a government fact-checking unit whose purpose is to identify, quote-unquote, fake, false, or misleading information concerning the government. Once identified, the platforms hosting this information are ordered to edit or take it down. This happened recently with the noted investigative magazine, The Caravan, which was forced to take down a story in which the Indian Army was accused of torturing three men who died in custody in Kashmir. The government has also weaponized its tax authorities to go after journalists, think tanks, and advocacy groups who represent a threat in some fashion to the narrative that Mr. Modi and his supporters want conveyed about India. The targets have ranged from Amnesty International to Greenpeace to India's Center for Policy Research, a premier think tank in Delhi. In a testament to the independence of online news organizations and the threat that independence poses to the government, reporters and editors have had their privacy invaded in myriad ways. Last October, the police in New Delhi, the law enforcement arm of the central government, raided the homes and offices of journalists who worked for a left-leaning portal called NewsClick. Several journalists were arrested and their laptops, phones, and cameras were seized. It was the newsroom's second government raid in 2 years. The first was done by financial authorities in 2021. Here you'll see authorities carrying out seized items from the raid. And around this time last year, tax authorities raided the offices of the BBC, just a few weeks after the release of a documentary that took a critical look at Mr. Modi's role in the deadly Gujarat riots of 2002, when he was the state's chief minister. The government also used the occasion to flex its new IT rules, forcing YouTube and Twitter, now X, to take down links to the documentary. I mentioned earlier that Hindu nationalists have used social media channels to organize hate, distrust, and even violence against Muslims, and I want to speak more about that now. Professor Varshney, who we were fortunate to hear speak earlier today, has argued eloquently that India is in the process of creating its own Jim Crow system, with Muslims denigrated into second-class citizens. The Ram Temple is a consecration of this new Hindu supremacist order, Mr. Varshney and others argue. It is clear that among the journalists facing persecution by the Modi government and his allies, Muslim journalists are most directly in the crosshairs, and I will give you just a few examples of that. Of the 13 journalists I mentioned who are facing charges under the Unlawful Activities Prevention Act, 9 are Muslim. In Kashmir, India's only Muslim-majority region, the entire population was plunged into a communications blackout in 2019, as lawmakers in Delhi, led by the BJP, voted to take away the region's statehood and right to self-governance. Before and since, Kashmiri reporters routinely spoke about being brought in for interrogations and jailed. The Kashmir Press Club, seen here, was forcibly taken over and shut down in 2022. Across India, Muslim women journalists have found themselves listed for sale on an auctions app. I won't give the name of the app here because it includes a vulgar derogatory term for a Muslim woman combined with the Hindi word for female servant. The more than 20 women whose personal information was shared in this fake auction had all reported critically on how the Modi government's policies had impacted religious minorities. They were mostly women in their early 20s, working for the hard-hitting new online journalism outlets that have proven so difficult to muzzle or control. Finally, I'm going to speak a bit about my experience as a journalist in India, which was a great privilege. First for the Associated Press and then the New York Times, I enjoyed many rights that my Indian colleagues at local news outlets do not. But the climate in India has become so antagonistic toward the free press that even those of us in the Foreign Press Corps found ourselves the targets of harassment, and sometimes far worse. A French journalist, Vanessa Duniac, who had been living in and reporting from India for decades, had to leave the country recently after the government told her that she could have her visa withdrawn or face harsher penalties for practicing journalism. An internal survey that I and others conducted over 3 years at the Foreign Correspondents Club of South Asia found that one of every two foreign correspondents is summoned by the Modi government to explain their reporting. I was summoned at least twice a year, a badge of honor. Usually the summons came disguised as a friendly invitation to tea. But just as soon as the tea had been poured, one minister or another would start berating us. One time, I remember the Minister of Information going to the trouble of printing the last 15 or 20 of my and other correspondents' articles. He then read headlines aloud, seemingly at random, with some sarcasm in his tone. It almost wasn't worth the tea. Beyond the reprimands, the government punishes those whose stories it doesn't like with short-term visas that make renting an apartment or even buying a cell phone service all but impossible. Nearly a third of the subcontinent is now off limits to foreign journalists without a special permit, a permit that almost never comes. No journalist has been permitted to report from Kashmir since the drastic political changes of 2019. Despite all that I've spoken about today, I want to end with optimism. Young Indians, especially young women, are clamoring to get into journalism. The universe of journalism schools is growing constantly in India, and Indians comprise the largest share of foreign students at many journalism schools in the US, including my alma mater, Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism. Even with the long hours and terrible pay in most Indian newsrooms, even with the high barriers to entry in Western news organizations, where old hierarchies are proving slow to dismantle, even with the real threat of false charges, arrest, doxing, harassment, physical violence, and financial ruin. They have Arundhati Roy on their side. The novelist is also facing charges for speech that the Indian authorities didn't like. We all have reason to hope that things will change in India, a place of infinite potential whose fate is very much tied to all of our own. Thank you.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's program featured talks by Nirupama Rao and Emily Schmall at the 2024 Camden Conference. For more information on the 2024 Camden Conference, including suggested reading, please visit camdenconference.org. If you missed part of the program or want to listen again, you can also find it on our website, mainepublic.org. Click on radio to access this program and many other archived Speaking in Maine programs. Music in this hour comes from Our Alarm Clock. Susan Tran is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine, and Speaking in Maine is produced by me, Jane Donahue. Thanks for joining us. This is Maine Public Radio.